Funding for On Point provided by Liberty Mutual Insurance for auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Obama and Romney draw their battle lines on the economy, Europe reels, a cry of coup in Egypt, and civil war in Syria. Yesterday, President Obama spoke at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, Ohio. He said a strong middle class is the backbone of a successful economy.
This November, you can remind the world how a strong economy is built, not from the top down, but from a growing, thriving middle class.
In Cincinnati, Ohio, yesterday, before a crowd at Seal Cop Industries, Republican challenger Mitt Romney went after the president's performance.
President Obama is on the other side of the state, and he's going to be delivering a speech on the economy. He's doing that because he hasn't delivered a recovery for the economy.
And in Colorado and New Mexico, huge fires burn on. Firefighter Rob Bozeman in Bellevue, Colorado, saw perfect conditions for wildfire.
The fuels are ripe. They are dry. Everything except the fresh spring grass is ripe to burn.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Jill Doherty of CNN, Howard Feinman of the Huffington Post, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. Joining us now from Washington is Howard Feinman, editorial director at the Huffington Post Media Group. Howard, great to have you back.
Hi, Tom.
Also from Washington, we're joined by Jill Doherty, foreign affairs correspondent for CNN. Jill, welcome back to you as well.
Hey, Tom. Thanks. Glad to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Howard and Jill.
Howard, let's go straight to the face-off in Ohio over the economy. Well, here's a little bit more from President Obama. This was Cuyahoga Community College, Cleveland, Democratic stronghold, northern Ohio. Here's the president saying it's about this whole election is about the economy, not just whether it's struggling, but about two different visions of the future.
Of course, we have a lot more work to do. Everybody knows that. The debate in this election is about how we grow faster and how we create more jobs and how we pay down our debt. That's the question facing the American voter.
How? In southern Ohio, Cincinnati, Republican stronghold generally, Seal Cop Industries. There was Mitt Romney, Republican challenger, accusing the president of just not doing the right things to heal the economy.
He will have all sorts of excuses. And he'll have all sorts of ideas he'll describe about how he'll make things better. But what he says and what he does are not always the exact same thing.
Howard Feinman, what's being laid out before the American public here?
Well, first of all, Tom, this is the presidential election in brief and in sum.
Yeah.
Ohio, North and South, Democrat, Republican, arguing about the economy, different strategies. President Obama's strategy is to turn the election into a referendum. on the direction of the country between his policies and those that he will try to describe as George Bush's brought back for a new day. So he wants to make Mitt Romney run with George W. Bush, essentially.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Same policy, same program. You want more of that?
Right. Like more of sort of what I call the Texification of America. Yeah. And what Mitt Romney's strategy is to make himself invisible and make Barack Obama run against himself.
Or run against the economy as it stands.
The economy as it now exists. Mm-hmm. And things are tough. There's been incremental progress for sure. The president was right. He overstated it in that one soundbite the other day. But there has been progress. But don't forget the president said in February 2009, I will be judged on my performance, and presidents are judged on the performance based on how the economy's doing. Things were on a decent, if slow, trajectory, but over the last few months there have been some bad economic numbers and problems in Europe, et cetera. It makes it difficult for the president. That's Romney's whole strategy.
Jill Doherty, Europe, of course, looming over all of this. I mean, you've got progress in this economy, though not nearly enough. But if Europe goes, things get a lot worse. In some ways, Mitt Romney just has to watch things unfold here on the current track. Europe not exactly making anybody confident these days.
Oh, quite the opposite. In fact, this is a huge threat. I mean, sovereign crisis threat. You've already got Greece going down and potentially pulling out of the eurozone. And you're looking potentially at the end of the eurozone. You have Spain and Italy. with enormous problems. The UK is responding with extreme measures to keep its banks secure. And all of this is, you know, potentially going to affect what happens in the United States. So it just makes things a lot worse for the domestic situation here in the United States and Obama's chances of getting reelected.
So, Jack, we've got internal factors, we've got external factors, and they're in the middle of it in Ohio, the battleground state among half dozen or more, as Howard says. There are these two, the sitting president, the challenger. What are you seeing in the choice they're offering the American people, Jack?
Well, I think they're both making cogent arguments. Mr. Romney says, if you think the economy is doing, talk to your neighbor. Well, it's very hard to find somebody who thinks the economy is really doing well. And it's almost a mark of, in fact, there was a focus group report from Columbus, Ohio, by Stan Greenberg and associates that pointed to some of the voters they talked to sounded as if they were in the middle of the Great Depression. I mean, people talking about, you know, what can we do for free, talking about diving into dumpsters to get food. It just sounded like something from another America. Mr. Romney is saying, talk to those people if you think the economy is better. On the other hand, Mr. Obama, I think, is very rightly saying, look, from comparable policies, you get comparable results. Mr. Romney is going to bring the policies of George W. Bush, and he names them. Tax cuts for the rich, deregulation for Wall Street, hawkish foreign policy, on and on. He's going to rerun those. Look what those produced. Do we want to go back? That is a good argument, but so is Romney's.
Well, it's not the first time, of course, anybody's been talking about the economy. Romney, a week ago today, he was in Iowa, Council Bluffs, and saying what he wants to do is cut back on government, going after the president for wanting to support public sector workers.
He says we need more firemen, more policemen, more teachers. Did he not get the message of Wisconsin? The American people did. It's time for us to cut back on government and help the American people.
Howard, what's your sense, or maybe you're looking at polls as well, on how Americans are weighing this choice that's been put in front of them? How are they responding to it?
I think they're pretty evenly divided right now, Tom. I think if you look at all the polls, it's a given that the economy's not doing great. But it's a question about where we go with it, and it is divided. We're divided as deeply and as evenly as I think we've been pretty much over the last 10-15 years or so. And I think it's going to be this way all the way down, all the way through to the last minute. And not marginal, but other factors are also going to matter. For example, on Friday, the administration announced that it was going to change its policy about deporting young Hispanic immigrants and not deport them if they came before they were 16 and if they have a clean record,
right,
and they're younger than 30. It was news that was leaked on Friday morning. It's going to dominate things because in a closely divided election like this, the Hispanic vote is going to be absolutely critical. And so you have the White House recognizing it's in a tough fight, in a tough defensive battle, looking for ways to augment the turnout of Hispanics, because without them they can't win. So that's one example.
They'll stop
how
deportation
evenly divided things are.
Stop deportation of some younger illegal immigrants.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, that's a little piece here, but people trying to decide. I mean, Jack, do you see a vigorous picture being painted by Barack Obama? Does the White House feel they've got a winning hand here when he says, "Don't go back to the years of Bush. It didn't work then. It won't work now." Does that work?
Well, you know, it's been a tough month for the White House. The Washington Post had a headline the other day, you know, panic at the Democrats are panicking because of the bad economic news, because of the president's hostages to fortune that he's taken with that comment about, you know, private sector doing fine with President Clinton off message and on. It's just bad and likely to get worse with the Supreme Court ruling coming up very soon and with all the turbulence from Europe. And so the president, I think, really has made a kind of defensive speech yesterday, 53-minute speech. My good God. I mean, who's that supposed to fire up? I mean, it's almost as if there's a reaction formation going on there. Things are really doing fine. I'm going to do better, and the economy will do better, and they'll do worse. But he keeps saying it for 53 minutes. Not, I think, a very confidence-inspiring speech.
All down to the economy. Let's hear from our listeners. Montgomery, Alabama, Ronnie's calling. Ronnie, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My comment and observation is the Republicans are saying that if we drop the Bush-era tax cuts, that it would be the largest tax increase in U.S. history. If that's the case, when they implemented them back then, wouldn't that have been the largest decrease of income of taxes in U.S.
Revenue? Well,
yeah. Reduction of revenue, and then they want to blame the current administration that there's a shortfall and a budget deficit for what they did. I'm saying reinstate the taxes to everybody. Let's go back. Let everybody have an equal footing in this thing and battle and try to get the economy back.
Ronnie, we've got it. I mean, fix that budget. But, Howard, here's David Brooks writing today saying, look, there's a bigger argument being made by Republicans here that we've just gone too far down this social spending path. We can't afford it. It's gumming up the fundamentals of our economy, and there really is a kind of scrape it all back desire here.
Well, I think David's framing the debate in a way that makes some sense, because we do have to decide how much government we can afford. But the key is how much we can afford. And the fact is that the Treasury has been hemorrhaging huge losses in revenue because of the two Bush tax cuts. Don't forget there were two back in the early days of George W. Bush. There was the first one, and then if you believe Paul O'Neill's account, they pushed the second one, and George W. Bush even said, wait a minute, I thought we just gave the rich people a break. Why are we doing another one? And Karl Rove, who's now, I think, the master of all he surveys in the Republican Party, and I wrote about him in our new iPad. We have a new iPad magazine that I wrote about.
Just Huffington. We'll come back and look at Karl Rove. We'll look at a whole lot that's going on this week at home and very much abroad. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Romney and Obama duel on the economy. Europe reels. Egypt reels. Great fires burn in the West. And, of course, the call of civil war, I should say, in Syria. Let's get our listeners right in. Boxford, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, John.
My observation is that oftentimes one hears conservative politicians and economists make the claim that the government doesn't have the ability to significantly affect the state of the economy. But yet, oftentimes one hears the criticism of the present administration in terms of he hasn't done enough. Sounds quite contradictory.
Well, yeah, you could look at it that way, but they're saying, you know, I suppose they're saying it just needs to get out of the way is kind of the Romney argument this week. And it just comes back to this, Jack. I mean, people putting out two visions. The president saying we've got to invest, we've got to take care of the middle class, make sure they're supported. You got Mitt Romney saying, you know, come on, let's get rid of a lot of that. Let's get rid of a lot of regulations. Let's get rid of a lot of government. David Brooks frames it up as, you know what, we can't afford what we built here. We've got to think in a new way. You've got Paul Krugman on the other side, New York Times op-ed page, saying, look, this is false. We have the resources to put people back to work, and it's time to do it.
Yes, and Krugman underlines the importance of public sector employment for overall economic health. Mr. Romney, I think he backpedaled from it. We quoted from him in Iowa last week saying, oh, we want to get rid of those teachers and firefighters and so on. And he said, well, no, I didn't really mean that. I meant we want to do what they did in Wisconsin and take away their right to collective bargaining. But Republicans do tend to talk about jobs in the public sector as if they're nothing but sort of net losses for the taxpayer, rather than, of course, sources of economic growth. According to Krugman's figures, we'd have, if government employment at all levels had stayed at what it was under George W. Bush, we'd have 1.25 million more jobs today. The unemployment rate would be down another percentage point. Everybody would be more prosperous because all those teachers and firefighters and so on who've been laid off, and there have been nearly 1 million over the last, or at least something like that over the last 4 or 5 years, would have jobs, would be paying into the economy. Mr. Romney tends to talk about that as if that's just a negative.
What's the lesson from Europe here, Jill? I mean, they're on fire, their finances, as the U.S. Wrestles with this debate. The lesson from Europe on the public spending side.
Well, I think, you know, you're, where are we? We're at the point of no return, unless you have the European Central Bank coming in and doing something, rescuing them. And so in a way, they're taking a page from Obama that certainly the UK is, you have to put money in, you know, to the economy as quickly as possible. But that is a debate in the United States, whether that actually worked. So it's, I don't know, it's a conundrum at this point as to what you do. But the contagion of that is huge, and it really is extremely dangerous for the entire world.
Mark in Kenton, New York. Thanks for calling, Mark. You're on the air.
Yes, I'm enjoying this discussion, Tom. And I wanted to make an analogy to business, because government is business. And when you approach a problem of spending and revenue, expenses and revenue, I just can't understand why we don't work with the spending problem and are going out to look for more revenue. We have a spending problem. If it's my family and I'm have expense problems, I certainly wouldn't go to my boss and say, listen, I'm spending too much money. I need a raise.
Of course, government's not exactly the same as family, but what about the president says, look, let's cut down our spending, let's get some more revenue from the rich who have done very well in recent years to help us balance this thing, keep everything in balance and not ditch the middle class? What do you say to that, Mark?
I say that we aren't spending enough focusing enough on the spending cuts. We need to cut our expenses.
Cut the spending. Well, I mean, Europe has done that. And Jill, that's had a kind of a mixed outcome in Europe. People are looking now at this, the austerity. Yeah, there's a natural impulse. Who doesn't understand what Mark says if you put it in terms of a family budget? But what has happened with the austerity push in Europe?
It sounds like the Germans, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, but the Irish had austerity and they got no growth now.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, you almost could say that that is the textbook now. Let's see, you know, theoretically, if you start slashing and not funding the government, what happens? Well, some could argue, look at Europe, look at Ireland, and that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, Mitt Romney in Cincinnati yesterday said, you know, business owners are watching this and they just don't feel confident under the Obama approach.
They feel this administration sees them as their enemy. They feel that the Obama policies have made it harder for them to put people back to work.
Howard, give us a credibility quotient here on this. Is that true? We hear it again and again. Is it true? Is it merited?
Well, I think it, I think to some extent it is true that that's the way small business owners view the president. But it becomes, in a way, it becomes a self-fulfilling and fateful prophecy for the president if they feel that way, because then they're not going to make the spending commitments and the investments that they need.
But feeling based on what, Howard? Is there really more regulation under President
Obama? No, I think in most cases not. And in fact, the left wing of the president's own party has been very upset with him for not being more rigorous in terms of regulation, especially as it regards the banks. I think one of the big problems here, there are several. One is the banks, which are not lending. They'll tell you in their advertisements that they're being very generous and aggressive in terms of lending. They aren't, and perhaps they're spooked by what happened when they overextended themselves a few years ago, but they're not really in the ball game. We can't afford to enter an austerity program because it will have the results that Paul Krugman says we're going to have. The fact is we have to do both things. We have to rationalize the tax structure, which means we have to spread the burden better than we have since the two Bush tax cuts. And we have to have an honest discussion about what we do about spending. And most of the spending is not discretionary spending. It's not programs on the environment or research or whatever. It's Social Security and Medicare in particular, which is going to, healthcare costs are going to balloon to close to a fifth of the American economy and or the budget in the next decade. How are we really going to pay for that? Can we really afford that? If we can't afford it, then let's hear the Republicans say how they want to do it. Paul Ryan has an idea, which is to essentially voucherize Medicare. Will the American people accept that? Will it really result in decent health care? These are the fundamental debates that we're going to have that we really haven't had yet. And I agree with the president that in that sense, what the election is about is the scope of federal programs. And this is one of the problems that the president has, he's really worked it. He's ended up in a position where he has to be the guy who defends government programs.
Yeah.
He has to be the traditional Democrat, and he wasn't a traditional Democrat when he first ran.
But here's Republicans, in a way, talking about breaking that compact with the middle class. But they're saying, we've got to do it, and trust us. It's kind of like the, you know, let the fire burn, and a new forest will grow. But the president then looking at that and saying, well, why should we believe that? You know, did it work last time? Here he was at Cuyahoga
Community. Especially in tough times for the middle class. So the problem with the president's stance here, and it's not his fault, is that at a tough time for the middle class in America, do you really want to say that we can't afford programs such as Medicare? Do you really want to say that?
But even beyond that, Howard, he's making the point that, look, beyond that, did the Republican policies work before? Here he was in Cleveland yesterday.
Their policies did not grow the economy. They did not grow the middle class. They did not reduce our debt. Why would we think that they would work better this time?
They're somewhere near the heart of the president's argument right there. Katie in Medfield, Massachusetts. What do you think, Katie?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, I wanted to kind of make an observation and comment that's related to an earlier caller who was talking about the huge Bush tax cuts and how kind of implied that if it wouldn't be for them, that the country and Obama wouldn't be in the situation that we're in. But I would want to point out that those tax cuts, which were huge, and there were, I think, two of them, those tax cuts were made under the Bush administration with that size government. Obama came in, and now we have a much larger government. Of course we're in a different situation, but it certainly isn't the Bush tax cuts that caused it.
Well, I don't know. I'm looking here on spending. Spending growth under Obama actually lower than under all modern Republican presidents. That includes George W. Bush. I mean, spending's always part of the formula, but then both sides are part of the formula. But, Katie, we've got it, and I appreciate it. Howard Fineman, Karl Rove pulling the strings behind all this?
I, in my shameless effort to plug our new iPad magazine, I was mentioning the Rove piece that I did. My point was that if you believe former Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill's account back in the early George W. Bush presidency, first there was one wave of stimulative tax cuts, and then the people inside the administration proposed a second one, and President Bush himself said, do we really need to cut the taxes for the wealthy people again? They already got one. And Karl Rove said, Mr. President, you have to stick to principle. And they pushed forward the second tax cut, which is something that Paul O'Neill vehemently disagreed with. That has set the policy agenda. That has basically set the framework. It's kind of drew the lines on the playing field, if you will, Tom, for the situation we're in now. Trillions of dollars in revenue have been lost to the Treasury as a result. Yes, spending is a problem. Yes, we have to have the honest discussion about entitlements and discretionary spending.
Mm-hmm.
But we also have to understand that the effort to stimulate the economy in the Bush days, first of all, it didn't really work, as the president pointed out in Ohio. All the real growth of the last 20 years was during Bill Clinton's presidency for the most part, and not during the Bush years. And so we have to rethink things, and do we want to let Mitt Romney, who's committed to the George W. Bush-style thinking, be the guy to be in charge of that? The president says, we dare not. You need me to make sure that we do it fairly.
Well, there's what's in front of American voters. Hampton, Iowa. George, you're on the air.
Hi. So I'd like to comment on, so Romney's trying to push the old Bush tax cut. I grew up. I'm only 20. I grew up with the Bush era in the Iron Office. And honestly, that really scares me that he's trying to bring back those tax cuts. I mean, I'm in a middle-class job. I make minimum wage, just, you know, a couple hundred dollars every other week. And on average, it's about $10 out of every $100, give or take, in taxes. And what has always baffled me growing up and just, you know, watching politics, trying to learn more about how all this works is how come the men that make millions and billions don't pay, you know, 10%, you know, as a number to throw out there, you know, in taxes? How come it's not even for everyone? How come some men who make more pay less?
Well, there's your Warren Buffett argument. Billionaire Warren Buffett, it raises the same question, George. Of course, if you're making minimum wage and thinking that's middle class. There we've got a whole new redefinition of what middle class means, as you will no doubt see, my young friend, as your expenses grow with age. I appreciate your call. I want to get to Egypt right here. We've got our issues. They've got huge issues. What is going on there, Jill? I mean, here we've got the military coming in, throwing out, dissolving the parliament. Well, I shouldn't say the military, a court in Egypt. But is the whole revolution, democracy thing, is this a coup? Is it on the ropes?
Well, that's what some people are calling it. In fact, one person, there's a blog out there, a Twitter post, I should say, by Hossam Bakat, who's with an institute, who called it, he said, the smoothest military coup. And then he said, you know, we'd be outraged if we weren't so exhausted. So people are saying that. I mean, essentially, you've got the military leadership. They've been in control of the country since Mubarak was ousted. And they do not like the Islamists. So that would be the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the parliament that was elected, first one freely elected in decades, mm-hmm. just about 4 months ago, comes in and they are Islamist-led. So when the court says, okay, we are going to dissolve the parliament, that is taken as a shot over the bow and, against the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamists. So this is creating enormous chaos, and the timing is horrible because this weekend, the runoff on Saturday and Sunday for the presidential election, and there the court also made another interesting decision and disturbing to some, which is they said there was a law that was barring former members of Mubarak's regime from mm-hmm. running in the election for about 10 years. And the court said, they rejected that law. And that means that Mubarak's former prime minister, Mr. Ahmed Shafiq,
and former Air Force general, so well known to the military.
Right. So we're back to the military. He can run. And you had yesterday, we were talking with Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, mm-hmm. about this. And she looked pretty stern. She said, you know, we expect a full transfer of power to a democratically elected civil government and no going back on this transition. It's very, very worrisome because, you know, you can get into the weeds on exactly why this all happened. But the result is that the political chaos, not to mention the economic chaos. I mean, their economy is in terrible shape. And the concern right from the beginning was that if they move into economic chaos, after all, that's what the revolution really essentially was about, that the country, a key country in that region, is, I wouldn't say doomed, but it is going to have reverberations, very, very serious ones.
I mean, Hillary Clinton can look stern, but it's not clear to me what enormous leverage the United States has here. And I really wonder if the military is so worried, is it really about the Islamists or is it about anybody in Egypt who would actually threaten their power? It appears that they want to stay the very active power behind maybe just a kind of a veneer of democracy there, Jill.
Yes. And, you know, here's where, let's say, politics, economics, and raw power come together, because after all, the military in controlling these really controls directly major portions of the economy. So it's not only in their interest in a power sense, but it's in their interest economically to keep the system going. And then you mentioned the White House and the United States. Don't forget, you know, about a month ago, I think it is, the White House resumed those aid payments to the military. Mm. And they had withheld them because of the crackdown on the pro-democracy people. So there is another problem.
Maybe it's enough billions to have leverage, but maybe not. Highest possible stakes there in Egypt. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. In other news this week, former Penn State assistant coach Jerry Sandusky is on trial for sexually abusing 10 boys over 15 years. Disturbing stuff. Victims' rights advocate Jennifer Storm spoke after the testimony from an 18-year-old witness known as victim number one.
He didn't want to be here. He didn't want to testify, but he knew he had a duty to do so that Sandusky wasn't going to harm any other children.
On Saturday, China launches its Shenzhou 9 rocket, which will dock with China's orbiting space laboratory. On board will be three astronauts, including Liu Yang, who will be China's first woman in space.
I thank the country and people for your trust and to let me to go to the space on behalf of all the women in the country.
What? Yeah, China's got an orbiting space laboratory. High excitement in Southern California as hockey's LA Kings defeated the New Jersey Devils 6-1 in Game 6 to take the Stanley Cup Finals.
For the first time in their 45-year history, a Stanley Cup for Los Angeles. The Kings are the Kings.
Kings are the Kings. We're looking at a week in the news. Romney and Obama dueling on the economy. Europe reels, Egypt reels, Syria, civil war, they now say. Fires burning, big fires in the American West. Let's get a call from Toronto, Canada. Doug is on the line. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. About Jamie Dimon, I felt he was kind of coddled on Congress, given a very easy ride in terms of what the casino capitalism on Wall Street. And I'm just wondering why we don't hear more from the presidential candidates on what should be done to rein in the banking industry and impose more regulation on it.
Well, yeah, there was Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, biggest bank in the country, sitting on this recent $2 billion, maybe $5 billion loss that's got so many eyebrows shooting up. He comes into the hot seat, quote-unquote, and it wasn't that hot. Here's one example of that. Senate Banking Committee on Wednesday, Republican Senator from Idaho, Mike Crapo, asking Jamie Dimon for advice about regulating the banking industry.
What other areas of oversight would be the most effective for us in terms of our regulatory structure?
So the regulators, I've been in regulated business my whole life. I think it's important to recognize that there have been improvements in companies, including J.P. Morgan, because of their audit and criticism. I think the most important things regulators can do is high capital, good liquidity standards, proper disclosures, proper governance, proper functioning risk committees. All those things won't stop mistakes. They will just make them smaller and fewer and far between.
Jack, what did you make of that? Please, sir, tell us how we might regulate you.
It was pretty abject, and they praised his sagacity and his, I think at one point someone said, "You're huge. Your bank is just huge." There was this.
Wow, you're big.
Yeah, I mean, it was really embarrassing. To the discomfiture of some of these Republican senators, a grudging sort of defense of Dodd-Frank seemed to emerge from Mr. Dimon. He replied that, yes, the financial system is safer than it was in 2007, and parts of the Dodd-Frank bill have helped to bring that about. He was asked by Senator Johanns of Nebraska, is it hard to, and navigate that red tape that Dodd-Frank and put in? He says, no, we're not having any trouble with that. We're going to be fine ourselves. So the Republicans didn't get this excessive regulation complaint from him. And even with the so-called Volcker rule, he said, well, perhaps parts of the Volcker rule would have helped to prevent this mistake, this miscalculation, this reckless misjudgment in London. But what really got me was just the fact that came out, 62, I think that was the figure, 62 members of the federal whatever that are, charged with overseeing this bank are resident in that bank every day, 62 members of them. And what's the policy toward them? Well, Mr. Dimon said, it's open kimono. We don't hide anything from them. And you wonder, well, wait a minute, 62 of them were there. While all this was going on, couldn't somebody someplace have asked a question? And of course, Dimon said, no, it was beyond them because we in management didn't know what was going on either. Nevertheless, you think 62 federal investigators there and they couldn't stop this in time.
Well, it does put a question in your mind about how regulation works. On the other hand, it's giant. Howard and the CEO himself didn't know.
Well, my first question is, do all those federal regulators get to eat in the executive cafeteria?
I doubt it somehow.
I think what Jamie Dimon said was actually pretty good in that he spelled out the main things that regulators need to do, and he made it sound kind of bland and bland. But if the key is to have the regulators actually do it and do it rigorously, and if I were President Obama's advisor on that, somebody said, why aren't the candidates talking about it? I would say, I would have the President Obama should have said, did you hear what Jamie Dimon said? Jamie Dimon was admitting that we need to do this and we need to do it right, and my administration is doing it, and Mitt Romney, who loves business too much, would never do it.
Well, that might be good politics, but Jamie Dimon's also spending millions, you know, out the other side of his pocket to lobby against exactly the sharpest edges.
Well, of course, but you have to hold him to his words and say, you're right, you conceded this, sir, and we are going to do it, and we are going to do it right, and Mitt Romney would never do it. That's got to be the argument that the president would make.
Caller Dave in Boston. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I'm calling, in regard to the Jamie Dimon issue. Mm-hmm. I'm a social worker, and I do what's called mobile crisis. So I go all around town and visit people in crisis. And it's just very clear to me that, this Jamie Dimon issue shows that the government has no concept of what's going on for most people in America. That these people with all of this money are just patting each other on the back, and they're really not connected to anything that's going on with 99% of the people who are walking around in this country.
You know, that's a real report and kind of from the streets, and I appreciate it, Dave. I mean, Jill, it can look sometimes like a very small circle talking to itself. About issues of very large consequence, but way up in the clouds above the life of a whole lot of people these days in terms of direct interaction.
Well, it's true. And, I mean, living in Washington, D.C., I mean, walk the streets of Washington, D.C., see how it is controlled by people who fight in public, slap each other on the back, eat steaks on K Street.
Real estate market booming.
Real estate market. Yes, this is la-la land compared to the rest of the country. It's very good here. And you can't necessarily blame either side, but there is some type of disconnect between the people who are running the country and the economic powers and the people on the streets. And it's beginning to sound kind of Marxist, but it is. I think it is true.
I want to look at the sort of hot back and forth this week with the Attorney General. It takes us right down to the Mexican border and then into the Senate Judiciary Committee. Here was Republican Texas Senator John Cornyn calling for Holder to step down, resign, because of his handling of the investigation into White House leaks and his involvement in the gun-running, government-in-guns program known as Fast and Furious.
The American people deserve better. They deserve an attorney general who is accountable and independent. They deserve an attorney general who puts justice before politics. And it's my sincere hope that President Obama will replace you with someone who is up to that challenge.
Up to that challenge. Eric Holder, Howard Fineman saying, no, I've acted correctly. That's not where we're headed here if he has anything to do with it. But the Republicans are really not letting go of this issue of, you know, the U.S. government in a gun trade into Mexico. We know all the violence there. What's going on with this tough, tough heat on Holder?
It's about 90% politics and 10% real concern. Look, that program was screwed up. I don't think there's any doubt about it. And I would probably say that the Justice Department hasn't used to use Jamie Dimon's phrase, been open kimono exactly on everything related to it. But there may be some reasons for that in terms of assets in Mexico, in terms of so on and so forth. It's a tug of war between Justice and the committee. I think there's some things you can criticize Eric Holder for and pound the table and demand his ouster for. This is great PR for the Republicans in that who could argue with being outraged about giving guns to drug dealers? And the shorthand version of it is devastating politically.
I mean, of course, they say that we were doing it to track how these flow so we could go and crack down. But, oh, boy, a lot of them went.
It was spycraft gone. It was sort of spycraft gone awry. But it's mostly political, and it's an attempt to put Holder, who is very close to the president, a very close friend of the mm-hmm. president's and so forth, on the defensive and try to make political hay out of it. That's my rather cynical but I think accurate view of it.
Let's go to New York. Lewiston, New York. Dominic is on the air line. Hi, Dominic. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay. What do you think?
I think that this deal has got to be running from above Holder down. And they're holding this back because if it comes to light what's there, this guy isn't going to get reelected.
Well, you mean Fast and Furious? You think somebody above Holder was running guns into Mexico?
I believe I'm right. I don't know if it's just New York State. But if they're selling full auto weapons to anybody who walks in, you can't do that. You got to have a federal license for that. It costs a lot of money and a lot of clearance to check. If they allowed these people to do this, if I'm correct, they're breached everything. And then they come in with papers that are blacked out, like they don't know anything, and they hold everything back.
Yeah,
yeah. That's not right. This is supposed to be the justice system.
Dominic, let's go to Jill Doherty. Jill, take us down to that Mexican border. And what they were trying to do there, Dominic's not buying the explanation we're getting. What was it supposed to be?
Well, I would actually have to take the Fifth Amendment on that, because it's one of those things that I haven't, quite honestly, haven't looked into. But I think that it was actually a plan to like an underground plan. But I think I will defer to my domestic colleagues.
I mean, Howard, Jack, just to clarify again, they were trying to figure out how guns were moving in that territory and how they were being used in crimes, and to do that, they were supplying them. I mean, Jack, here's Dominic saying that had to have been run from higher than Eric Holder. Well, the only thing higher than that is the White House. Does that sound anywhere near credible to you, Jack?
No, it doesn't. And, of course, it's a program that began in the Bush administration. So if it's the White House, then it's two White Houses. And, you know, Dominic's sort of rationale for this is in the conspiracy theory there, is sort of close to Daryl Issa's. On Sean Hannity's show, he says...
This is the congressman who's really gone after...
Yeah, he's the chairman of this committee, and he says that what's really going on here is that it was part of a secret Obama plot to release drugs to release guns to these drug lords, so that the guns could then be used to kill federal agents, which would then cause a national uprising in support of gun control. That's the conspiracy theory.
And of course, one Border Patrol agent did die.
Yes, indeed. But it's,
my goodness.
And even Eric Cantor, the minority leader, has suggested that ISA is overreaching.
Well, that sounds like a. We'll let that one stand just where it stands. Jill, take us to Syria and the talk of civil war this week. Now, this has been terribly violent, terribly bloody. The violence has gone up and up. Hillary Clinton's looked at Russia, said they're sending in helicopters, and then, oh, no, they weren't sending in helicopters. What's happening in Syria, Jill? And who's got the main irons in the fire here?
Well, I'll just remind you, you know, we had a briefing at the State Department just, I think it was 2 days ago, in which essentially the press secretary threw it back at a reporter and said, "What would you do?" And that is kind of the dilemma right now. Nobody knows what to do. They don't know in Washington. They don't know in Moscow. But we have at least 10,000 people dead. You have monitors from the United Nations visiting these cities where the Assad regime is massacring civilians with heavy weapons, artillery, tanks, etc. The observers themselves are being attacked. They're not supposed to be there to stop the fighting. They're supposed to be taking notes and finding out what happened, but they may have to be pulled out. Then you have a plan, Kofi Annan's plan, 6 points, and they can't. The first part of it is stop the violence. So that is not working. And then you have echoes of Bosnia. The word Bosnia has come up in briefings. The word cleansing has come up. And then, as almost a side venture, you have this tiff between the United States and Russia over the Russians supposedly providing combat helicopters. Secretary Clinton brought it up. She said they're supplying the Syrian government. The Russians fired back and said, no, it's old equipment. So where are you right now? I mean, it's almost at the point where you cannot see any really good out. The strategy seems to be you keep up the pressure on the regime, you keep up sanctions, you try to pressure people who are supporting Assad. And then on the other hand, a lot of attention to Russia to try to get the Russians to use whatever influence they may have with Assad to bring this to conclusion. I think there's a question, though, Tom. I mean, how much influence do the Russians really have? And then
when Assad's fighting for his life, and not just him, but Alawites all over Syria.
Absolutely. It's game over if he is out. Mm-hmm. So and this has been compared to in a lot of other countries. It's not like a lot of other countries. It's not like Libya. It's much more serious and much more complex. So at this point, What are they going to do? Well, Hillary Clinton and many in the Western community say, go to Chapter 7. Chapter 7, that's
UN Chapter
more
7.
Sanctions mm-hmm. and potentially military action. But nobody realistically at this point thinks there will be military action.
Howard Feynman, do you see the U.S. in all this as first and foremost spectator, first and foremost an active part agent here?
No, I think we're mostly a spectator. I think I think we've done what we can to call global attention to it. I think we put whatever diplomatic pressure we can. It's up to the Russians, really, to decide what happens in Syria. They supposedly have offered Assad asylum, so have the Iranians. He's not going, and the people I know think it's going to end bloodily.
Well, it's very bloody already. One bright spot this week out of Myanmar, Burmese opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi out and about saying, you know, is she too ambitious for her country, for her vision of what ought to go on in this world? Well, she says, unless we aim at achieving the best, we're in danger of having to make do with the least that is tolerable. Wow, house arrest for all those years, and she comes out with a fresh voice that is good to hear. Aung San Suu Kyi free and out in the world this week. Jill Doherty with CNN, foreign affairs correspondent there. It's always great to have you. Thank you so much, Jill.
Thank you.
Howard Feynman with the Huffington Post. Thanks, Howard.
Thank you, Tom, very much.
And Jack, many thanks. This
thank
is
you.
Thank you. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.